Welcome back. Hello, everyone. You see, we are starting almost on time, which already feels like a big victory considering the stresses of the first plenary, and hopefully without any technical problems this time. So, Carlotta, how are we to go live? Ready to go live? Yeah? Okay, good. Excellent. So welcome back, or those who arrived now, welcome to this session. I'm delighted to be the chair of this session, where we're going to look at domestic litigation. So not in one country in particular, we were asked at some point. The idea here is to look at what's happening at the national level. There are so many different peculiarities, characteristics of what's happening in domestic litigation, and there is so much happening in domestic litigation. This is really the area that in the last year has seen the most action. Of course, the other parallel sessions have a lot to talk about, but I feel that this is really where we have the most. And the way we tried to organize this panel is by covering litigation against states and against corporates. So I didn't introduce myself. My name is Joanna Setzer. I'm an assistant professor at the Grantham Research Institute at the LSE, where I research climate change litigation and legislation. I coordinate our research and policy work in this field. And doing some a combination of data collection, analyzing data for research purposes, and also all the policy implications that this area has. And this is, I think, a lot of what we will see here in this panel. And this will feed into the final plenary of today, where we are going to focus on the impact of all of this. So the way we will organize this is that we have these amazing panelists here. Everyone will have around 6 minutes to introduce their topics. Then Corey will ask a round of questions, and we will open for Q&As from you here sitting and those who are joining remotely. I don't want to take any more time because I want to have time for all of you and the questions. So I want to introduce one by one the speakers. Otherwise, I'm afraid you might mix up who's who. And I will start with Sarah Mead, who will talk about domestic litigation against governments. So Sarah is a legal associate at the Climate Litigation Network, a project of the Urgenda Foundation. And she is also the coordinator of a really interesting project that is led by IUCN called WCL, the World Commission on Environmental Law Climate Litigation Project. And Sarah will tell you a bit about both things that she do. So thank you very much for joining us, Sarah. I think Corey can pass you the microphone and let's begin.
Thank you. Yes, this is working. So many thanks, Joanna, also for hosting us today. It's a pleasure to be here. I think it's, despite the chaos of organizing an event during COP, it's extremely timely to have an event about climate litigation. Because as the negotiators very nearby here are failing to take the necessary action that they need to, we need to really be talking and discussing and exchanging ideas to improve the quality of the climate litigation that we bring to desperately close that ambition gap, which will almost certainly still be with us at the end of this COP26. So, I think the key takeaway from what I would like to discuss today is if states fail to bridge the ambition gap nearby, then they can and should be held accountable in national courts, be it under human rights law, constitutional law, tort law, or international law. So, as Joanna said, there has been a huge wave of climate cases, particularly since the Paris Agreement. And today I'm going to focus on a small subset of these cases, and they are Urgenda-style cases, or we call them systemic mitigation cases. And these cases are important because they focus on the ambition, so the overall ambition of the government. So they are specifically cases against states or their organs. So today we're going to hear the whole range of cases that are happening at the domestic level. But these ones are against governments for their overall ambition on climate change, be it challenging their NDC or their 2030 target, so on. And their goal is to obtain an order which requires the government to take real action. And I should say there is now about 40 of these cases that have been filed. Urkenda was one of the first of these cases, but there are many now. They are primarily in the global north, and that is because those are the countries that are most responsible for climate change and have the biggest responsibility to mitigate. So I wanted today to quickly cover where we've come from and what gains we've made, drawing on some of the key cases. And then I'm just going to touch on, you know, some of the difficulties and what we need to do to close those. So as Joanna said, I work at CLN. We support organizations or individuals that are bringing these cases. We draw on our experience at the Urkenda Foundation, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with the case. It was brought against the Dutch government, and it succeeded in requiring the government to increase their ambition from, it was about 17% at the beginning, to 25% by 2020. And that resulted in a huge change, a policy shift at the national level. So what we see, so there's actually now this huge body of jurisprudence that courts can draw on. And what we've seen is that while there have been some difficulties in North America with justiciability of these cases, that has not been replicated around the world. We have seen cases in Netherlands, Germany, Belgium, Canada, Colombia, France, and Nepal, all recognizing that systemic mitigation cases are cases that are justiciable, that can be heard by the courts and adjudicated. And we have also seen courts widely recognizing that governments have a duty of care, be it under tort law or human rights law or constitutional law, to mitigate climate change. So this isn't some sort of kind of wild suggestion or kind of hypothetical scenario that we're discussing now. This is something that's pretty widely recognized. And that shouldn't be a huge surprise, because governments have all signed, all governments are basically members of the IPCC. They have signed the reports that say that it is now unequivocal that climate change is happening, that it's a linear relationship between emissions and warming. And they've also signed reports which indicate the implications of failing to do that, so the human rights implications. So, many of the requirements to create a legal duty under whichever law or principle you're going under. And thirdly, they have recognized, and this is one of the really consistent findings, that the fact that everybody's contributing to climate change does not mean that the government doesn't have a duty. The drop in the ocean defense has been really kicked out, and that's been in Urkenda, Neubauer in Germany, L'Affaire du siècle in France, and the Belgian climate case. And we're also, I should say earlier, I said that Canada, there had been some kind of difficulties with justiciability, but we have the Mather case, and we have the lawyer with us here today, who, where there has been fantastic findings, which suggest that justiciability will be able to be, those issues will be able to be overcome. So this is not to say the nut's been cracked. There is a huge amount of work to be done, and there's a lot that this community of practitioners and academics can do to assist in creating better climate cases. And I think that, we have to accept that judges are being asked to resolve a hugely difficult situation. These are difficult, the science is complex, but this isn't unique to climate litigation. There is a whole host of types of cases that are really difficult. Just very briefly, I'll introduce one project that's happening. There is the World Commission for Environmental Law that Joanna mentioned, recognized a gap in judicial, in kind of resources specifically designed for the judiciary. And so with Dr. Margarethe Wevering Singh, who's at Leiden University, we are with the Climate Change Specialist Group looking at creating a resource for judges which draws on all this emerging best practice that I've just touched on to create a resource which is issues-based. So in all these cases, we see the same issues always coming up, separation of powers, causation, attribution, duty of care. And so it pulls together all of this practice that we're seeing around the world and distills what we would is emerging best practice. And that can then help them resolve these issues. We've done that with the help of the Vance Center and many voluntary contributors. We have some of our experts here today. We have, I think, Joseph Udell, who's working with Christina Voigt, and we have Dan Galpin, and I think Annalisa was here, and Joanna is also one of our experts. So we have, it's really great that we have a number of academics and practitioners who have come together to help us with that. If you'd like to know more, please reach out. But I will leave it at that. I think that, there is, in wrapping up, I want to echo Tessa Khan talked about accountability and climate justice. And we're probably going to leave this COP pretty disappointed. And so it's really, we need to put together our forces to kind of close this accountability gap, because if you hear them when they do their speeches, governments sound pretty good. But unfortunately, that's really not being translated into action. So I'll leave it there. And I'll hand back to Corey.
I think back to me. I will introduce the next speaker, who is going to be Melinda. So Melinda Jansky is an international lawyer. She is a solicitor in England and an attorney at law in Guyana, and she has been leading litigation against offshore oil in Guyana. So also thank you very much for joining us. To you, Melinda.
Thank you, Joanna, and I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to join this distinguished panel. And I'm especially glad to see Carol Mufford, as he's been a strong ally in our fight. I just realized I can take my mask off. Sorry. Yeah. Carol's been a strong ally in our fight against dangerous oil production offshore Guyana, South America. I start by paying tribute to the children who submitted a complaint to the Rights of the Child Convention Committee. Children have a right to a healthy environment. And I also pay tribute to the Torres Strait Islanders, who on the 26th of October sued the Australian state over climate change. Indigenous peoples are not responsible for climate change, but their ways of being are being destroyed by climate change. There are three cases from Guyana that are part of the global fight to protect the climate from fossil fuels, and I represent the litigants in each one. The first case challenges ExxonMobil's petroleum production license and is in the Court of Appeal. The second case, Thomas against the Environmental Protection Agency, cut ExxonMobil's environmental permit down by 18 years. Exxon has to get a new environmental permit next year or cease production. The third case is a landmark constitutional case, and it's the focus of this presentation. The first claimant is Dr. Choi Thomas, a scientist, a dean at the University of Guyana, and the Thomas from the permits case. The second litigant, Quadad de Freitas, is an indigenous Wapichan youth from the south of Guyana. Thomas and de Freitas say that the greenhouse gas emissions from Guyana's oil production are incompatible with the right to a healthy environment. Article 149J of Guyana's constitution says that everyone has the right to an environment that is not harmful to his or her health and well-being. And it says the state shall protect the environment for the benefit of present and future generations through reasonable legislative and other measures designed to prevent pollution and ecological degradation, promote conservation, and secure sustainable development and use of natural resources while promoting justifiable economic and social development. The right was put into the constitution following my legal analysis and lobbying about 20 years ago during Guyana's constitution reform process. It's in the fundamental rights section, so it's enforceable. Dr. Thomas's affidavit stated that the emissions from oil will exacerbate the climate crisis, increase ocean acidification, and increase the harm to the health and well-being of Guyana's children. And he says this imposes a disproportionate burden on his children. They will suffer the impacts long after his generation has died. Mr. De Freitas's affidavit says that his spiritual health and well-being are closely connected to the forests and savannas and their biodiversity. He says, I live with nature around me and it nurtures my spirit. Climate change affects me personally and makes it more difficult for me to survive and to live a traditional life. The case was filed against the state, represented by the Attorney General of Guyana. Esso, the local subsidiary of ExxonMobil, has applied to join and was recently joined. Obviously, I can't discuss the merits of the state's defense, but it's a public document. It does not admit climate change, ocean acidification, the greenhouse effect, the increase in the global temperature, or the link to fossil fuels. Paragraph of the state's defense denies that the direct emissions from oil production are contrary to Guyana's nationally determined contribution and contrary to the Paris Agreement. And it denies that direct emissions make the environment more harmful to human health and well-being. The state also denies that the indirect emissions constitute a violation of Article 149. Do the emissions from Guyana's oil violate the right to a healthy environment? That's the substance in the case. 20 years ago, in the case of the Crown against the Secretary of State ex parte Daley, Lord Steyne, in his concluding remarks, said that in law, context is everything. Having dealt with the substance, let me put this case in context. First, Thomas and De Freitas is possibly the biggest of all climate change cases. ExxonMobil says it's found 10 billion barrels of oil. Burning that would emit more than 4 billion tons of greenhouse gas. Recently, we've heard of wonderful victories, including in France, the case of the century, which dealt with 15 million tons of greenhouse gas. Thomas and De Freitas is 286 times bigger. Let me put it in the global context. In 2020, the UK emitted close to 330 million tons of greenhouse gas. If Thomas and De Freitas succeed, these two wonderfully courageous individuals will save the Earth from the equivalent of 13 years of the UK's emissions. Second, the case is not just high stakes, it's unique. The bulk of climate litigation so far has been in the UK, Europe, North America, Norway, Australia, the big polluters. Their historic emissions have broken the climate system, raised the Earth's temperature, and made the ocean more acid. Thomas and De Freitas is different. Paragraph 12 of the state's defense says, data from our world in data shows that to date, Guyana's share of global greenhouse gas emissions from 1950 to 2019 is less than 1%. Guyana is not a big polluter. This is a new and unique situation in climate litigation. Third, this case raises novel questions of international law. The state's defense refers to the principles of equity and common but differentiated responsibilities, which it says are woven deeply into the fabric of every significant climate change treaty, including the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, Kyoto, Paris, and it refers to the Stockholm Declaration and the Rio Declaration. Paragraph 20 of the state's defense says that requiring Guyana to abstain from developing its petroleum resources amounts to imposing an obligation equal to that held by the most developed countries and the industrialized developing countries, violates the principle of international equity and is contrary to the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities. The next step in the case is for the claimants to file a reply, and that will be a public document. In conclusion, Thomas and De Freitas is possibly the biggest climate change case ever. It's unique in climate litigation, and it raises novel questions of international law. I close by expressing my deep appreciation for Ronald Birch Smith, an excellent lawyer, and my co-counsel in Thomas and De Freitas. Thank you.
Thank you, Melinda. Thank you. So for Guyana, now we move to Brazil. I would like to introduce you to Sueli Araújo. Sueli is a lawyer and an urbanist. She was the president of Brazil's environmental agency, IBAMA, the federal level. And now she's a senior fellow at Brazil's Climate Observatory. Thank you very much, Sueli.
The Climate Observatory is a network of 71 NGOs that are united by the climate issues. And we started to deal with litigation, strategic litigation, in the beginning of 2020. And now we are involved in some important cases in the first degree of the justice and also in the Supreme Court. I will highlight firstly the newest case, the case that we have proposed last week, a week ago. And in this case, we already have a decision of the judges appointing a date for the section of negotiation at the end of this month. This is processing very fastly, and we are very happy with this. In this case, the Climate Observatory is against the federal government, demanding a plan for the contention of the climate crisis. We have a law on the national policy of climate change. And this law established the plan, a national plan that is a very important instrument. And the federal government doesn't care, and really doesn't care about this rule. This plan is not being implemented, and also is not being updated. And we are, for this reason, we are demanding in the justice that this plan really become an important policy instrument. Let me read a little about the content of the object demand. The action evokes points such as the dirt power of the Brazilian state in protecting the environment established by the national constitution, the principle of prohibition of insufficiency or deficient protection, the principles of prohibition of retrogression, and of the ecological existing minimum, to require the judiciary branch, to oblige the government, the federal government, to present an updated national plan on climate change, consistent with the new needs informed by the IPCC. This is very important in this demand. We don't want a plan that is consistent with the current numbers of the federal government. We want new numbers, more ambition, more a plan that is consistent with the climate crisis. We think that this case specifically will be the most important one in our agenda in the Climate Observatory. We have also some cases that must be showed, but must be mentioned. I will choose three of them more, but will be more summarized here. The second case is the case that the Climate Observatory is supporting six young activists against the government. They are fighting against the carbon trick maneuver that was made by the federal government. The Brazilian government has two documents in the Paris Agreement. The first one in 2015, and the second one 5 years later. And the second document, they made a kind of accountability that generates the possibility of generating in 2030 400 million tons more of carbon dioxide. We call it pedalada climática. It's a kind of maneuver, trick maneuver, quantitative maneuver. This action, this case, has already effects. Because here in COP26, Brazil announced a new update in the NDC that undoes the maneuver. And we think this was result, this was made because of this judicial action. I want to make comments about two more actions. The actions that are in the Supreme Court, requiring that the money of the Amazon Fund that is paralyzed since the beginning of Bolsonaro's government, we are requiring that this money must be used. This demand was proposed by four political parties, with the technical and judicial legal support of Climate Observatory. And also we have the action in the same sense related to the use of the money of the climate fund. These already have the action, the case of the climate fund has already effects, because the federal government has transferred the money that was paralyzed. Then we think we are going well. We have a lot of work to do. And if anyone wants more details or notes about other cases, we can talk.
Thank you. Thank you, Sueli. So we move now from litigation against the state to litigation against corporates. And to do this, we have our two last speakers. First, Nigel Brooke, a London-based partner and insurance specialist at Clyde & Co. Nigel, too.
Thanks, Rana. So I'm going to, there's been a lot of developments in litigation against companies. I'm going to focus on three groups of cases, all of them strategic. One is about specifically about emissions, another is about greenwashing, misleading investors, and the third are about duties owed to members and shareholders. So the highest profile case in this sphere of the last 12 months is undoubtedly Milieu de Fonsi against Royal Dutch Shell. And this was a decision in May. It's the first ever decision holding a company to account for reducing its emissions. The court did this by creating a new unwritten duty of care. And so duty of care has been inspired by a variety of sources, some hard or hardish law, some soft law. So it's relying on Articles 2 and 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights, the right to life and the right to family life. Also on the UN guiding principles of corporates and human rights. These principles have been around for 10 years and they're beginning to be implemented in national laws around the world, France, Germany, Finland, and soon the EU will put them into force. But this is prior to this that the court has taken that as inspiration for this new duty of care. and also OECD guidelines, another soft law inspiration. And it took its cue from the Kender case against the Dutch government. So it's very much in that same vein of taking rights, which are typically, of course, owed or to be protected by governments, and transplanting those into duties owed by corporations. This is a duty that's owed, according to the court, by Shell to the citizens of the Netherlands, and only the citizens of the Netherlands, no one outside that. So that was the limit of the jurisdiction, but the instruction applies to all of Shell's operations worldwide. So over 1,000 companies under the management and direction of Royal Dutch Shell, headquartered in the Netherlands, are instructed to cut their emissions by 45% by the end of 2030. 45% because that is the reduction that would be needed, according to the scientific evidence presented to the court, to keep the world within 1.5 degrees of warming. And it's not just their own emissions, which are of course a fraction of the total emissions, it's also their scope 3 emissions, the emissions from the consumption of their oil and gas products. So there they have to use their best endeavours to reduce the emissions of their consumers, their customers. So it's a radical judgment, it's first of its kind, and all the various defences put forward by Shell were dismissed. It's unfair to pick on us, we only represent 1% of global emissions and so on. It's under appeal. I heard today it's likely to be heard, that appeal, in the summer of 2023. But already we're seeing similar litigation. In the last few weeks, we've seen litigation filed in Germany against Mercedes, BMW and Volkswagen. And there the relief sought is to force them to switch entirely to electric vehicle production by 2030, 5 years ahead of the EU deadline. And in the meantime, to limit production of internal combustion engine vehicles in a very precise way, so that the total emissions from those vehicles don't exceed a certain amount. Also learned today that there is going to be plenty more litigation like this around Europe. I think the next one might be against Eni in Italy. We've also just been given a handbook by Milo de Fonsi telling anyone who wants to know how to go about bringing cases like this. So this is, regardless of the outcome of the appeal, it looks like this now has some momentum. And this is very much a theme. We've seen that a successful case against a government spawns other cases against governments. It seems we're already seeing this quite rapidly with cases against companies. Turning to greenwashing cases, this typically up to now, when greenwash is called out, it's usually by bodies complaining to an advertising authority. But what we've seen for the first time is the courts being used in Australia. This is an NGO called ACCR bringing a case against against Santos, who are a natural gas primarily company. In their annual report filed this year, they've said they aim to get to net zero by 2040 and that they sell clean fuel. And the allegation is that both of those statements are misleading because they both rely on carbon capture and storage being used at great scale, and that technology hasn't yet been shown to work at scale, let alone economically. So that's the nub of the case, that they're misleading investors. But using consumer legislation, so again, just another example of imaginative use of the courts. But that's only just begun. It's a long way from a hearing. And then that's the case in Australia. There's two more in Australia worth noting. There's a case that's been going for a while called McVie against Rest. So it's an individual suing his pension fund. He's been investing into this fund since 2013. And he's saying, you're not telling me about the climate risk inherent in the portfolio of assets that my pension is invested in. You've got to tell me more. This case was settled at the end of last year, and what the pension fund has agreed to do, first of all, they've accepted that climate change is real, that climate risk is real, and it could actually impact substantially on the performance of the fund over time. They've agreed to adopt the gold standard of climate risk reporting and management, TCFD, and to keep members updated. So it's a pretty good result, I suppose, if in terms of litigation And then one final case, again, brand new, nowhere near trial, Abrahams against Commonwealth Bank. And again, this is a novelty. This is under Australian law, shareholders are allowed to have disclosure documents. So he's saying to the court, please oblige, order Commonwealth Bank to give me all the documents they have relating to their financing of fossil fuel projects around the world, and including all of the sign-offs by the board. And so this is, again, a novel way of trying to hold the bank accountable. Commonwealth Bank had already settled a previous case and agreed to improve its performance in terms of climate risk, but this is another front opening in that battle. And just in closing, I think the EU and Australia, where all of these cases I've mentioned are taking place, are hotspots. Yes. Yeah. So sorry. This means that.
No, Nigel. Wrap up.
Yeah. So Australia and the EU are real hotspots for climate litigation.
Before he started the presentation again, but so, well, hopefully this mic is working. If I also can ask the audience, in case there are technical problems, please do write a message, and otherwise we won't know. So. Last but not least, Carol Muffett is president and CEO of the Center for International Environmental Law, CIEL. And over to you.
I was reflecting at the start of this event, how many people there are in this room and at this conference that I don't know. And that's really important because it is a sign of how far we have come very quickly. Because when we started the climate litigation movement, the rooms were smaller and people were telling us we were going nowhere and we were going fast. And the truth is we are exploding. And with that comes obligations. And so what I want to start my discussion with today is actually answering for you a question that was asked in the last session that I think warrants a different answer for those of you who are lawyers. Are any of you law students? Good. One of the questions that came up at the end of the last session is, how do you deal with extractive industries that are exploding in places? How do we fight multinational companies in places around the world when they have all the money and all the power? And here's the answer. First, do no harm. This is really, really important, and all of you who are lawyers now are going to be lawyers need to understand that the cases that you pick up, that the stories that you pick up, they're not your stories. You are there to support, you are there to advocate. And what you're there fundamentally to do is to provide access to justice and access to remedy. And this is really fundamentally important because if you cannot articulate how at the end of the day, the communities and plaintiffs you are representing will be better off than they are today, your case will fail. If your goal is policy change, that's outstanding. If your goal is political progress, that's admirable. But if your case cannot look, if you can't look your plaintiffs in the eye and say, this is what I'm going to do my damnedest to win for you, your case will fail. And the cases that are succeeding are the ones that can answer that question, answer it credibly, and answer it from a place of belief. I come from the US, where we have witnessed an absolute explosion of climate litigation over the last decade, and litigation that continues to accelerate. And one of the things that Joanna asked me to talk about is the corporate accountability dimensions of that litigation and the roles of how denial and greenwash are playing into it. I think one of the lessons that you learn from that litigation is the cases, you know, cases are surviving, cases are moving to the merits. They are surviving, you know, there are surviving efforts to pull them into federal court and kill them over and over again. These cases, despite how they're characterized in the media, are generally winning on fundamental grounds. And the reason that they are winning is because there are concrete harms that can be identified and specified. When you articulate your cases, look for, you know, what can you do to make your plaintiffs' lives better? You know, not 100 years from now, but at the end of this case. And this is what's driving the evolution in cases that we're seeing in the US right now. We have more than 30 jurisdictions in the US have brought suit of one kind or another against major oil and gas companies. Why the oil and gas companies? Because the oil and gas companies are producing the fossil fuels and putting them into the stream of commerce that ultimately are the primary drivers of climate change. I think one of the major developments we've seen in that litigation is that the role of industry denial becomes critical, not because industry lied. Absolutely, it's true that people don't like to be lied to, and from a political perspective, that's critically important. But it becomes important in the legal context, because anybody who is putting a product into the stream of commerce without adequately disclosing the risks intrinsic in that product is failing to warn consumers about those risks. We've seen this in Massachusetts, we've seen this in Michigan, we've seen this in Minnesota, we've seen it in the Philippines, that jurisdictions around the world recognize that when you fail to disclose, when you conceal the fundamental intrinsic risks of your product, that sort of deceit runs afoul of the law in almost every jurisdiction on the planet. And I think this is one of the things that has landed these companies not only before courts in the US, but very recently before the US Congress, testifying before the House Oversight Committee on that decades of denial. And I think one of the things that's remarkable about that Oversight Committee hearing, and that speaks to where the litigation is going now, is that the first half of that hearing, yes, began with the history of denial. What did your company know? When did your company know it? What did your company do about it? Absolutely, let's get that on the record. And once it's on the record, it can't be taken back again. But this brings me to where the litigation is going now. What we're seeing is a rapid evolution, both in the US and globally, away from holding companies accountable just for the present impacts of their past operations, and increasingly for the inevitable future impacts of continuing business as usual in the face of insurmountable, incontrovertible evidence that we're heading towards a climate, that we're in the midst of a climate crisis. And I think this means that the denial and greenwashing that courts are increasingly looking at, and we saw this in the congressional hearings, are going to go beyond, you know, did you conceal the science in the past? It's going to be, what are you disclosing to the public, to regulators, to investors about the gaps between your current business model and 1.5 degrees? What are you disclosing to the public about the difference between saying that you're going to get to net zero in 2050, and actually, if you're Shell, being able to deliver that cut those emissions in half by 2030 using technologies that really exist? I think this is the next wave of climate litigation, and it's going to come fast and it's going to come hard. And I think it's really important to recognize that that litigation is going to focus increasingly not just on the oil and gas producers themselves, but on the financial actors who are supporting, financing, and facilitating the ongoing extraction of fossil fuels in the midst of the climate crisis. And I think the last thing that I'll leave you with is, this is about more than denial. I think we have the UN Human Rights Council has just recognized that we all have a shared right to a healthy environment. We have the IPCC having recognized code red for climate. In the midst of that, I think the next wave of litigation we're likely to see is going to start looking at financial actors and oil and gas companies alike and saying, if you're continuing business as usual, when we all of us know this about climate reality right now, what you're investing in is human rights violations, egregious human rights violations on a global scale. And you can be, and you will be, held accountable for it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So I said at the start that there was a lot of action, and these presentations from such a diverse group covering such diverse group of lawsuits as well just demonstrate that. They demonstrate the breadth, the scope, the ambition, the creativity. It is really extraordinary what has happened in these last few years. So before we go to you for questions, Corey will do a quick round of questions with our panelists. So I will introduce Corey, Climate Law Fellow at the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia University. Thank you for joining us too, Corey.
Thank you, Joanna, and thank you to all the panelists for your incredibly interesting presentations. I'll just say a few words in summation and then move to a few questions. I think from these presentations, we got an incredible sense of the variety of climate litigation. From Sarah, we learned about systemic mitigation cases and groups attempting to hold national governments accountable for the climate harms. From Melinda, we heard about climate litigation in Guyana against the government and also against ExxonMobil joined in those cases, attempting to hold the country accountable for the harms that fossil fuel products specifically will cause to the entire world and to Guyana. From Sueli, we heard about climate litigation in Brazil and the incredibly variety in just the cases that you're presenting against the government there to hold them accountable specifically for their Paris Agreement commitments. From Nigel, we moved to the cases against corporations side and saw the incredible creativity and variety in cases in Europe and Australia attempting to hold corporations accountable for their role in the climate crisis that we're facing. And then finally, Carol, in his speech, talked both about the US climate cases attempting to hold corporations accountable and also about a call to lawyers to really drive forward how we're going to make plaintiffs' lives better. So to think about this and the variety that this presented, I think it shows us how difficult it is to box climate litigation into one category, how difficult it is to say, oh, climate litigation just means this or just means, as some people might assume, a systemic mitigation case. I think it also shows how defendants are going to be challenged in their ability to pass the buck in climate litigation cases from saying, okay, this is a case against the government, actually it's corporations' fault. Well, there's cases coming against corporations. Oh, this is a case against a corporation. Oh, it's the government's fault. Well, there's cases coming in the pipeline against governments as well. But in the face of this variety, I think we also see commonalities and common threads driving forward. We see across continents, countries, and local contexts, we see actors trying to hold corporations accountable for not corporations and governments accountable for their climate hearts, trying to parse out who is responsible for this climate crisis that we all find ourselves in. A lot of observers of climate litigation may have mentioned that courts and the judiciary are an imperfect body to deal with these cases. And indeed, a lot of the defenses in the cases that you heard about attempt to defend and deflect against these cases by saying, this isn't the right venue. We shouldn't be hearing this in court. But in the cases, in the successful cases that we've heard about, and in the cases that are still coming, we've seen courts grappling with that question. We've seen courts taking on jurisdiction. And we also can think about this in the context of executive and legislative branches failing or unable to address the problem that we're facing. So in the face of that inaction, I think we're going to see more and more cases like the ones you heard about today, pulling that lever of power to hold them accountable. With that summation, I think we'll go into some questions for the panelists. First one to Sarah, I was wondering if you could speak to the specific challenges of enforcement in systemic mitigation cases.
Thank you, Corey. So in response to this question about enforcement, it is obviously the big kind of looming question. You get a remedy and then, you know, the court has to deal with enforcing it. And I think it's in the case of perhaps I focus on Urgenda, With that order, the court required the government to reduce quite significantly its emissions. And from the very first judgment, so in 2015, the government agreed to do that. And what it had to do in order to achieve those reductions were, for instance, close a coal power station, invest millions in renewable energy technology, and in the course of the litigation, it also agreed to phase out fossil coal and to adopt a new target. So we saw a very a kind of overarching change in climate policy in the Netherlands. How do they then enforce that when they don't do that? And there are still tensions with that even in the Netherlands. Is, I think, a question when you're dealing with the global north jurisdictions, so throughout Europe and the US and Australia, if the government refuses to implement that decision, you really have a bigger problem. You have a problem with the rule of law. And I think that's, I think we expect in countries, you know, in all countries around the world, that if the judiciary is going to order, make an order, that the executive is going to comply with it. So I think when in our cases, in our systemic mitigation cases, we very much assume and expect that the government is going to comply. And that is what we're seeing in those cases, because the government then has to accept that it doesn't appreciate the rule of law and it's not willing to comply with the order of its very own judiciary. I just wanted to also pull up, though, Nigel, just a one clarification on the Dutch case, because the Shell case was based on the Urgenda case. And you called it a novel duty of care. And I just because it's really relevant to the replicability of this case, it wasn't a novel duty of care. It was the it was in the Dutch Civil Code. And I pulled it up because it's something that we're always looking at, because we're trying to make this case. We're trying to bring similar cases all around the world. And the reality is, in most civil codes and even in common law countries, you have a duty of care. And the, how it is in the Dutch civil code is that a person who commits a tortious act against another person that can be attributed to him must repair the damages, and a tortious act is regarded as a violation of someone else's right and an act or omission in violation of a duty imposed by law or what, according to unwritten law, has to be regarded as proper social conduct. And basically all the court said, and everything else was entirely correct, they drew on a range of other standards in international law to simply say, well, proper social conduct is complying with human rights. In the case of the Netherlands, it's complying with, it's not knowing that you're going to cause harm and going ahead and doing it anyway. And so that's the only thing I wanted to raise, because these are not, they're not so novel. They look really novel because it's a huge problem. Climate change is like, wow, oh, it's so big. How could the courts possibly deal with it? But the courts are simply applying very established legal principles to what is indeed a really serious problem. But of course, that's exactly what they should be doing. They should be dealing with these difficult concepts and applying them with existing legal principles. But that's all I wanted to add. Thanks. And that was a bit of a tangent.
Thank you, Sarah. Next up to Melinda and Sueli. I was wondering, I know many of the cases that you described are ongoing, but if you could speak to potential challenges of enforcement in those cases or in similar cases, and whether there's any particular context of enforcement challenges in the Global South.
We don't have decisions in these cases, but a problem we will have problems regarding the power of the federal government. And the federal government, in the case of Brazil, has a very archaic vision about development. And the current government is imploding the national structures of environmental protection of climate policy. And then and they are really powerful in our political structure. In the case of Brazil, for me, this is the most challenging aspect. We have problems with this kind of archaic vision even with progressist governments, not only with this Bolsonaro's government. The problem in the next government, I think Bolsonaro will not be re-elected, but even with a new government problem, this should be a challenge to be resolved, solved.
Thank you, Corey. I mean, I think enforcement is something that is so very specific to a country, to its legal system, and to the culture of the country. And I may be being over-optimistic here, but I do not foresee any problems in Guyana with the enforcement of decisions in the cases. If we just look back at the case that cut Exxon's environmental permits down by 18 years, the Environmental Protection Agency amended that permit immediately. And so the new permit was changed, and Exxon have to apply for a new permit, and they've got to do that because the permit now runs out and on the 1st of June 2022 instead of in 2040. And I'm sure most people who are in the English jurisdiction will remember the case of M and the Home Office. No one is above the law. If there is a court order, you have to obey it. If you don't, you're in contempt.
Thank you both. This next question is to both Nigel and Carol, and I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit more about the Shell case. Nigel, you spoke at a little bit of length about it, and thank you, Sarah, for your added clarification. If you could speak to whether this might drive a wave of cases forward. You have this handbook of how these cases might be brought, and speak also to the challenges in enforcing these decisions as well. So both of you, if you want to speak on that.
Kick off, and I'll get the microphone right up. So I think we're already seeing the Shell case inspiring litigation. We've seen that this new German case, in fact, there's two separate cases, but in parallel with each other. There's a case I didn't mention against an oil company involved in the oil business as well. But, and by the sound of things from what I'm picking up at COP26, it looks like there will be more to come. So I think it is definitely inspiring litigation and the fundamental basis of it as well, not just the decision itself, but the whole basis for this of putting together the basis for, as you say, a tort-based a duty of care in this particular context of emissions. In terms of enforcement, there is an issue here, of course, that it's the deadline for compliance, the final deadline for compliance, is 9 years away. And unlike in the Okenda case, by the time the case got to the Supreme Court, after about 5 years, the government had less, just over a year to comply. There's an end of 2020 deadline. Here it's 9 years away. And so if you were going to take a progressive approach to that, then of course you should be revising your emissions now to get there, cutting about 5% per year. I gather that's not yet happening. Shell are not yet changing their plans to comply with the judgment, and they are appealing it. And of course, something that was commented in the plenary session, there's different ways of complying. So nominal compliance would be to carry on a business as usual, and then sell 45% of your operations in 2029. But that would not really move the dial. So I think there is an inherent issue here. Given the way the judgment is structured, can that actually be enforced in the short term? Maybe we'll see more litigation about that.
Yeah, I think with respect to the Shell case, I think it's important to highlight not only the key findings out of that case, but the context in which it occurred. I think we've talked a lot about those findings, but I really want to emphasize two things out of those findings. You know, yes, the decision applied to all Shell subsidiaries everywhere, 1,100 of them, and every oil major on the planet, I guarantee you, is looking at that precedent. And just as critically, the decision applied to all of Shell's emissions, not just the emissions from production, not just the emissions from refining and operations, but the emissions from their produced products. And this is significant because that is the vast majority of this industry's emissions. And we know from the industry's own documents that they've been able to quantify what those emissions were and their impact on the global climate literally since the 1980s. And so I think that fact that decision extended to scope 3 emissions sets a critical precedent that courts around the world and certainly plaintiffs around the world are going to be looking at. And finally, and this was just alluded to, I think the other really difficult thing for Shell and the other carbon majors in this decision is that the timeline is that Shell has to cut its emissions by 45% by 2030. Shell did in fact move soon thereafter to offload a bunch of its underperforming Permian assets to get those off of its books at a time when it thought the Permian was not going to be profitable. And this is something that we have to look at. But I think really fundamentally, I think what this means is that these companies are going to face a real-time problem of complying in ways that if they were focusing on a 2050 target would be very, very different. The last thing that I want to say is on the context, and note that what is one thing that's really important about that Shell decision is that within 24 hours of that decision being taken, we also saw massive losses for both Exxon and another major oil company in their annual shareholder meetings, where Exxon lost a vote that ended up with 3 new board members on its board demanding climate action. And we saw other oil majors face similar rebellions from their boards. This speaks to the fact that the emerging litigation risk for these companies is not only going to be from organizations like ours and plaintiffs and folks from civil society, it is going to be from investors, it's going to be from shareholders, it's going to be, as we've already seen in the Exxon case, from pensioners. And I think this is what I mean when I say we're at the dawn of a much more diverse range of litigation against these companies, and it'll define their future for the next several decades.
Thank you so much. Look, we are running perfectly on time. That's excellent. And that gives us time for Q&As. Actually, Carlotta, I was thinking the first plenary, we didn't give a chance for people in the audience because we owned the technical problems to those online. So this time I want to start with the audience. And I see already some hands up. Carol finished talking about pension funds, pensioners. And I know there is a question here in front of the probably the newest lawsuit filed last week. And so a hand starts here. Then, okay, let me see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, so we have 5 questions. Everyone should be quite quick in asking, and Kate will help moving the microphone. So we'll collect probably 3 and then 3 questions. I'm sure there will be a third one by then.
Ian. This isn't so much a question, but a short explanation.
Yes, that's fine.
Okay. Hi, everyone. My name's Ewan McGahey from King's College London, and thank you to the panel. So I was just asked to talk briefly about a pension case that we're bringing. I work in the Law School of King's, and we are bringing an action against the biggest pension fund in the UK, University Superannuation Scheme, £89 billion to divest from fossil fuels. We're bringing this as a derivative action with Dr. Neil Davies at the University of Bristol. We crowdfunded £55,000. We got direct access barristers. We tried to get solicitors, but they're all being employed by USS at some point. I'm not sure if we visited Clyde and Co. But so the nature of the action is a derivative claim. And it's saying that the directors breached their duties to act for proper purposes and use their powers properly by not divesting. And that comes from a case called Palestine Solidarity, where the Supreme Court held that you can have an investment policy, anything that you like, but if it causes significant financial detriment, then you are not exercising your powers for proper purposes. We say that fossil fuels have been the worst performing asset class every year since 2017, as well as burning the planet. And therefore, directors are breaching their duty by not divesting and also not having a credible shareholder voting policy to decarbonize all the other companies that they are invested in. We found out that Harvard had divested using very similar arguments to ours. I mean, we were sort of thinking the same thing. They said that it violated the duty of prudence to stay invested in fossil fuels. So that's fantastic. And we're also saying that these duties have to be interpreted in line with the European Convention. Like in the Shell case, you have to interpret the Companies Act, Section 171, follow the Constitution, proper purposes, in line with the right to life under Article 2 and the right to family life under Article 8. So I hope people can support us. Anybody in USS here? No, not very many academics? Okay, well, at least one. So that's where we're standing. We filed the particulars of claim last week, and so hopefully we'll get permission.
Thank you, Ian.
I'll be brief. My question is from Melina. Basically, I would like to try to develop a little bit more about the remedies that you're seeking in your three cases in Guyana, and how do you make sure that they don't become a liability for the government? I mean, by giving grounds for ExxonMobil to take the government to international arbitration, you know, talk about creeping expropriation, denial of environmental permit in the future, based on the production share agreement.
Thank you very much. So all of the cases are to do with enforcing existing law. And that binds the government, and that binds every single corporation in Guyana, and it binds every single government agency, it binds every institution. We're not looking to change anything. We're simply saying you, the government, must obey the laws of Guyana. And the remedies depend very much on the individual case. So in the first case that I mentioned, where the case challenges the grant of the petroleum production license, the argument there is that the minister who granted the license breached the Environmental Protection Act because he issued a petroleum production license to three companies, only one of which had an environmental permit. The second case, again, was an enforcement of an existing regulation, and that cut the permit down to 5 years. And the third case is looking at the Constitution. I won't say anything more about that because I think the courts rightly in Guyana don't like these issues to be discussed in the public. They want you to wait until you are actually in court, and I think that's very sensible.
What was the third question?
This is probably mainly to Nigel and Sarah about the Dutch Shell case. And I just wanted further reflections on how realistic the idea of applying those principles in perhaps the UK and other common law jurisdictions might be, where you know, we don't have a civil code and we're probably not as internationalist in outlook as the Netherlands courts might be.
So I'm actually from New Zealand originally, so New Zealand trained, so I understand this problem. Well, it's good timing. Last week we filed our partners that we were supporting in Australia filed a case, and that was a case brought by two Torres Strait Islanders against the Australian federal government. And Australia has obviously a common law jurisdiction and also no protection of human rights at the federal level. Still there is the common law torts, negligence, nuisance, and so forth. And so that case is being brought, in many ways it's similar to the civil case of Urkenda and Shell, but it's bringing together all the evidence with relation to the science of climate change, what the Australian government knows, and arguing that the federal government has a duty of care that it owes to the Torres Strait Islanders to take sufficient climate action to protect them. And it's just it's a straight tort claim on the common law. And so I imagine the same thing could be brought, but much easier, in fact, in many respects in the UK. Australia is a difficult jurisdiction because they don't, unfortunately, they have quite a hostile attitude to international law and international law instruments. But I don't think the same can really, I think the UK is more open in that respect. Obviously, also the convention, there is more human rights protection by the Human Rights Act. So I think Australia is one to watch, but I think that in all honesty, we've got to the point where the climate crisis is so serious, and that judges can see from the facts, because that's what they're dealing with, that there are multiple different, you know, be it tort law or human rights law or constitutional law, that there is this duty that arises, and it's just a matter of kind of formulating those arguments with the tools or the law that you have in front of you. So, but I can share more about that Australian case and the submissions with you.
Yeah, I think the UK, although we have the system, and as you said, it is a tort-based system, tort travels, but I think the judging from the case law we have, I think it would be quite a stretch, and the judiciary, the current attitude of the judiciary, it would be quite a stretch. I think at the moment, in the European context, it's more likely to be successful in a civil law system than the UK's version of the common law system.
Now, we will do the second round of three questions, but you will all ask, and we will then answer quickly. So we, yes, raise your hands. I know Caillou, and then Dan.
Thank you. First question to Carol. Carol, what are the prospects of increased litigation of corporations challenging the progressive measures of Biden's government and trying to delay climate action from the current government? Question to Sarah and Nigel. How do you assess the difference that the Dutch court has made between scope 1 and 2 emissions, that those are, you know, Shell has an obligation to reduce on them, but then on scope 3, they have to use their best efforts. Does that undermine somehow the duty of care or anything? And finally, Nigel, on the litigation against financiers or pension funds, do you know how the regulators are seeing this kind of litigation? I can imagine, for instance, that in Brazil, a case like the one that you mentioned in Australia, this Brazilian central bank would be like really concerned about the sacred value of banking secrecy. So I think they would stand, you know, with the financial institutions.
Oh, let me ask you now. All right. Actually, my question is also for Carol and anyone else who wants to answer. Carol, in your excellent presentation, you noted that you thought that the next wave of climate litigation to hold, you know, corporations accountable, including fossil fuel companies, would be about the gap between their plans, their business model, and what is necessary to be done on the world stage. And, you know, I presume in terms of individual corporations' duties to not undermine what needs to be done. Do you regard the present substantial round of investments by a number of these fossil fuel companies in so-called negative emissions technology projects to complicate the effort to hold them accountable?
Hi, my question is to Sarah and anyone else who has thoughts on this. It's about causation, establishing causation in climate litigation cases. So if there's an extreme weather event, let's say in one region, what are the innovations in courts to establish causation and also to isolate culpability if there's one entity like a corporation or a government, let's say, that's being blamed for this?
We'll start with Nigel and then move left.
Okay. So
I start with the last question first. So attribution. And so this would be looking at the American cases and also against UGO, against RWE. So ultimately, if you do establish your duty of care, to get your damages, as you say, you have to establish that anthropogenic emissions have made whatever it is more likely, rising sea levels, windstorm, wildfire, and so on. Attribution science has really moved on. It really only began in about 2003, but it's matured to the extent that it's now actually in the IPCC's AR6 report that was published in August. That is now regarded as part of the corpus of climate science. So it's not been deployed that much in the court so far, or attempted to be deployed. And there is a school of thought that where it has been deployed so far, it's not been deployed well. It hasn't been a good choice of climate science. But I think that aspect of it, it'll be interesting to see it tested. The most likely case to test it first would be the Yuya case in Germany against RWE.
So I'll take also the last question, but remembering the others. It's also, I think, worth keeping in mind that there is obviously some cases are looking backwards and some are looking forwards. So Nigel, I think, has discussed those cases where you are actually looking for damages, and then you can actually link that with the developments in attribution science, and there's a lot of movement in that field. But a lot of these cases, particularly those against governments, are relate to looking forward. So there are positive obligations that are on the government to change what they're doing in terms of climate action going forward in order to reduce the harm for either those, whoever is in their jurisdiction. And so in those cases, causation is really not a huge issue. It's not something that's kind of occupying the courts, because it's not necessary to prove a specific connection between emissions and harm. You only have to prove that if you continue doing the harmful behavior that you are, you will cause harm to those within your jurisdiction. And that is extremely easy to prove, because it's in the IPCC reports that they've signed, that if you continue to every ton of greenhouse gas emissions contributes to global warming. So in that respect, causation's not a huge issue. As regards the question from Kayo about their scope 3 emissions, did you want to?
Just to make that point again, that the court has said to Royal Dutch Shell, you have an absolute obligation to cut your own emissions and scope 2 emissions by 45% by 2030, and you have to use best endeavours to cut your customers' emissions. I think this is based on a recognition that those emissions are beyond the control of the company, unless it just, there are things it can do. It can obviously just reduce its sales by 45%, which then meets all three scopes. Or it can move rapidly to sell less carbon intensive products. In fact, on podcast, some of you may have heard a few weeks ago, Ben Van Buren, the CEO of Shell, was saying, well, look how difficult this is. We actually do sell aviation fuel that's made from it's biofuel, but it's 4 times the price of conventional fuel. So that would be the pushback from the likes of Shell, that this actually, in absolute terms, is hard to control, short of actually just reducing their output by 45%. But I think that that's going to become a lively area, because the strategic litigation is really about scope 3. That's what moves the dial, not scope 1 and 2, in the context of the oil majors.
Thanks. Yeah, I wanted to take a few. There were a few questions that I think are very closely related, and they lead into this causation question. And I want to take them sort of seriatim. You know, do we expect the oil industry to fight back and try to oppose climate progress? What's the chance of that? The chance is 100%. They're doing it right now. They're doing it incessantly. And so, absolutely, I think we are seeing the industry, even as it declares it's seeing a new day, even as it declares it's changed its path, continuing to work to obstruct climate action. And I think that leads into the, and I think the use and threat of use of ISDS and the Energy Charter Treaty is emblematic of that. And so I think we are adapting our strategies to equip countries, to equip subnational jurisdictions, to take those risks into account and to respond accordingly, because I think one of the things that the industry benefits from is the chilling effect of that risk of trade and investment disputes. And so equipping companies to respond is key. I think the last thing, and this goes to I think Dan's question is related to the question about embedded emissions. Is net zero, is the company's investment in net zero technology is going to make things harder, more complicated? It's just the new wave of greenwash litigation. That is what we're going to be looking at now, is how to expose the gap between what these companies say they're doing and what these companies say the technologies will do and what the realities are. And so I think we're taking account of that. And I think, you know, nowhere is this clearer in you know, the Shell decision, because the truth is that, I mean, it is absolutely the case that the vast majority of the emissions are scope 3 emissions. It is also absolutely the case that carbon emissions, CO2 emissions, are an ineluctable consequence of the production and sale and use of fossil fuels. It's really important to recognize this. CO2 emissions are what happens when everything in that chemical process goes exactly to plan. And so this goes to that question of causation. It's really important to recognize that when you put this product on the market, you know that the inevitable consequence, unless something intervenes to stop it, is global warming. And so essentially the pitch towards net zero is, oh, well, we're going to do this, we're going to continue to sell these products. The inevitable consequence is global warming, but hey, maybe if governments sink billions and billions and billions of dollars in it, maybe we'll pull some of that CO2 out of the atmosphere. And that's a pretty poor, you know, that's a pretty poor approach to corporate accountability.
Thanks. So I'm just going to try and sum up a bit, because I know we're getting close to time. To give you an example, in the Thomas case, one of the exhibits attached to the affidavit is ExxonMobil's internal report from 1982, which says that the temperature of the Earth will increase by about 1 degree. And I think when one looks around, obviously the companies have known that for a very long time. Then you have the code red, basically, of the latest IPCC report. I don't think anybody seriously now can doubt the science. The science is extremely strong. Okay, the reports are written in something that, you know, approaches gobbledygook for the average person, and so are not, in fact, that accessible. But the science is clear and the science is strong. I just want to make one final point, and that's when it comes to the corporations. Guyana has extremely strong laws. So, for example, in the environmental impact assessment, you have to say the direct and indirect impacts of your project. You have to identify, describe, and evaluate those impacts. And you have to do that and say what those are on the climate, the atmosphere, and the ocean. So the information is there. And this is from the Environmental Protection Act, which I wrote in 1996. So it's 25 years old. And in the Constitution, there are also other provisions relating to the rights of the children. It incorporates the rights of the Child Convention. It requires courts to say that the best interests of the child are the primary concern. There are protections for Indigenous people's ways of life. So I think, coming back to Carol's point about corporations wanting to use trade mechanisms and that it has a chilling effect, when you come to Guyana to do business, you are required to respect those laws, and it may just be that our laws are that much stronger.
Look, we have 2 minutes before finishing right on time. I think we did amazingly well. This was a brilliant, brilliant, fantastic panel. All your contributions were extremely valuable, the questions. There's so much happening, but there's also, I think, so much thinking and so much that still can be, that we will still witness in this field. So we will have Kate McKenzie reporting the summary of this panel to the next plenary, when we will discuss impacts of litigation. Of course, there are limitations. Of course, this is not saving the world, but it is extraordinary what has been reached in so just a few years. So we will discuss that in the next plenary. Kate will report, and then we finish today's first, I think, probably ever litigation day at COP, with drinks and canapes upstairs where we had lunch. Once again, thank you all very, very much for your time, for your insights, for your contributions. And I'm looking forward to the next plenary. Thank you so much.